This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 19th of January 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, it's been a week of high-stakes diplomacy between America and Iran, with a prisoner swap and fresh new sanctions. My guests Daniela Peled and George Brock will look at the often bumpy rapprochement between the two nations. Then, with the rise of fringe candidates around the world, is the global political centre crumbling? We'll discuss the evidence for and against all that, plus a trip to Davos to find out if it's actually worth it anymore. And we'll discover which spy agency has just been named the LGBT Employer of the Year. That and more, starting right now on Midori House. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are regular Monocle 24 contributors, Daniela Peled and George Brock. Daniela is the acting managing editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and George Brock is professor of journalism at City University here in London. Daniela and George, welcome to you both. It has been an eventful week, I think it's fair to say, in US-Iran diplomacy. First came the prisoner swap, in which Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post Tehran correspondent, along with a handful of others, were released from prison in the country. Jason had spent more than 500 days behind bars. Then came the lifting of international economic sanctions at the same time as new sanctions were imposed, targeting the country's ballistic missile program. Meanwhile, oil prices slumped to $28 per barrel yesterday, a low not seen for more than a decade. And let's face it, George Brock, that might get even lower now that Iran is able to sell the huge reserves it's been stocking up for quite some time.
Well, there are plenty of people saying that oil will go to $20 a barrel or even lower. We've been practically unprecedented, territory. It's not the only thing that's going wrong. China has just posted some of the worst economic figures for a quarter of a century. A lot of capital is flowing out of the emerging markets in the developing world. And I'd have thought the people in Davos are probably a bit worried.
Well, we'll come on to Davos in a moment. But Daniela Peled, looking at the oil price since we started there, in some ways, a low oil price is quite good for those nations that actually rely on oil to consume rather than to sell.
Yeah, you'd have thought, actually, I mean, in some ways, it's great news for the American consumer, you know, the average guy in the street. I mean, I think it will take a while for Iran to get up to speed on its production because it's been a long time that it hasn't been managing, you know, selling massive amounts. I think they want to be up to a billion barrels in the next year, but from what I understand, the infrastructure has not been invested in. So I think the sort of emotional shock to the market is what is being currently experienced. I don't think they're going to manage that kind of production immediately.
And Daniela, on this issue of Iran-American relations, this brave new world isn't going to see the two sort of going hand in hand, skipping through the Middle East, sorting things out, making sure everything's nice and sorted and fine and everything, is it?
No, I mean, no, of course not. And I don't think that there was any expectation, or there shouldn't have been any expectation about this. This isn't some sort of moral or ideological reckoning. This isn't Iran taking stock. This isn't sort of Germany thinking at the end of World War II, like, how are we going to change going forward? This is something very practical, but the alternatives, or the lack of alternatives, are probably worse. And I thought it was quite funny that an Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, was taking credit for saying, we have saved the world from Iran and we will continue to do so. But in some ways, you know, he and others like him have proven quite useful because there's a lot to be sceptical about this deal. And I'm quite a big fan, sort of opposing forces, although perhaps in his case, rather extreme. There has been quite a high price paid for this deal, a high price paid for the hostages being released. But I think we have to be very practical about that and not have very many illusions that somehow we're ushering in a great era of reform and democratization in Iran, because that's not going to happen.
George Brock, do you think that that we're going to instead sort of be led into an era where you know, everyone has relationships in the Middle East? They're just not very good, but at least there are relationships, at least there are going to be discussions between people.
Well, between America and Iran there are going to be relationships. I don't really think the relationships between Iran and, for example, either Israel or Saudi Arabia are any better, and some people would say that they're considerably worse just as a result of this deal. And there are plenty of other people who are fighting other people. I mean, we have Sunni versus Shia. That's not ethnic groups. That's not states. It's parts of the same. It's parts of the same religion. So there are plenty of divisions still happening. I think the American-Iranian relationship, is likely to be somewhat fretful. It's very, very subject to what happens in politics in both countries, including what happens in the American presidential election, which is about to start. I don't think the deal will fall apart, but it will be the subject of a lot of strain. And it really is the kind of risk you take for very good reasons, but you have to wait to see how it works out. And don't forget that although the Americans have knocked 400 people off the sanctions list, they've kept 200 Iranians on it for human rights and terrorism grounds. So it's not, you know, hand in hand into the sunset.
Daniela, on the issue of the Iranian economy, do you think that other nations within the region, be they Saudi Arabia or Israel, will welcome a stronger economic Iran, or are they likely to be fearful?
Well, they're not going to welcome a stronger Iranian anything, where it comes from the economy or international pressure. I mean, this is another interesting way in which relationships in the region are being remade by this deal or strengthened. For instance, the relationship between Iran and Israel, Saudi Arabia, much worse. Relationship between Israel and Saudi Arabia, covert as it is, much stronger. You know, we're seeing a very strong developing alliance against Iran. I mean, the people across the Gulf take the threat from Iran very, very seriously. And I mean, also the issue is in Syria as well. You know, the issue of Iran's proxy militias. I mean, Hezbollah for sure, and also to another extent the Houthi in Yemen. This is something which alarms all the other actors in the Middle East. So yeah, economic clout, I think, one of the many, many worries.
And George, on that point of, you know, Iran's influence in Syria, Yemen, elsewhere, it's one thing for America and others in the West to say, well, we have better diplomatic relations with Iran now. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Iran's going to turn around and say, OK, fine, we agree with you. We'll interfere less, as you see it, in Syria. We won't support our friends in Yemen.
Oh, no, certainly not. It wasn't part of the deal at all. And the nuclear deal could only ever have been got if all of those kinds of other elements weren't brought into it. I honestly don't think the American-Iranian deal makes the slightest difference to the difficulties of trying to sort out what is happening in Syria, to name only one of the places where Iran is trying to make things harder for people.
No, I mean, I inject a rare note of optimism into this. I also think it's important to remember that Iran is a rational state actor and wants to be part of the international community very much on its own terms. But isolationism is not, you know, its sort of sole trajectory. Obviously, it wants to exert power and it wants to expand its regional influence. And, you know, we go back to the glory days of empire, but also it wants its place on the world stage, and it wants to be... it does not want to be a pariah state in the way of, you know, obviously North Korea, for instance, wants to be. I do believe that it wants to be wants to be part of the, can we say, family of nations?
Perhaps we can say family of nations.
Perhaps, you know, the sort of extremely crotchety great uncle, but it wants to be there.
Okay, from global geopolitics to look at domestic political trends, although domestic political trends that we're seeing in many different nations. Of course, in the last few years, we've seen the rise, or indeed the comeback, perhaps, of political extremes on both the right and the left, from France to the US. But does that mean that the political centre has crumbled entirely? George, we've just seen a debate in the US for the Democratic nomination. We're seeing, you know, really incredible numbers for Bernie Sanders when you see this is a man who declares himself to be a socialist in a nation where socialism is perhaps not as widely encouraged as it might have been in elsewhere in Europe. Let's start with the US first of all. Why do you think we're seeing such support for political figures that are, for want of a better phrase, outside of the mainstream?
Well, let's not forget that the figures who look as if they're outside the mainstream can sometimes insert themselves into the mainstream because the competition from the centre and the middle and the established places isn't very strong. I have only to mention the name of Jeremy Corbyn in England for you to understand what I mean. People thought he was marginal, it was impossible that he would be elected leader of the Labour Party, all of that happened. Therefore, when we look at Bernie Sanders and his challenge to Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination, let's not go around saying Bernie Sanders, he's so marginal, he's a socialist in a country that never elects socialists, that nothing can happen. You know, it's now beginning, you know, sober commentators in the States are now saying, well, we still think it's likely to be Hillary Clinton, but she's get, you know, it's beginning to look like a long, hard fight. Sanders is raising far more money than we thought he was. His polling rating is better than we believed it ever could be, and so on. So you're seeing some of the same thing. And people talk about populism. And populism is fine as a term, but it doesn't explain a lot. It is that people just don't trust the competence anymore of these politicians in the centre. We moved from a sort of ideological left versus right age to some degree to a series of politicians, particularly Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, whose pitch to the electorate was roughly, I'm more competent than the next guy, elect me, I will manage whatever occurs. Now, that worked for a bit, but unless you have those kinds of political talents and you're very lucky, if you don't really have principles, values and a philosophy, you don't look very good when you come under pressure. And that's what's happening to the political centre in places like the States and France.
And also, Daniela Pelled, that doesn't work when actually you aren't that competent. And many people will say, well, look, there was a global financial crash in 2008. Governments of the centre-left or centre-right have really struggled to deal with this. Is part of the problem here the fact, or part of the reason for the both left and right extremes, we'll come on to the differences between those in a moment, the fact that those in the centre weren't very good at the things they said they were going to be good at?
I think it's a cyclical issue as well. Absolutely, Tony Blair was the master of the art of this, you know, capturing the centre and fighting the battles in centre. He was very successful. And now Blairites or Blairism are dirty words. Now, I think the focus will shift again, and we'll go back to centrist politics, because George is absolutely right. You need to be an extremely good political operator to make up for the lack of a strong ideological or policy bent. What's happened? The story of Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party here, you know, the marginal becoming the mainstream. I would like to say it's early days, but from what we see so far of what's happening with the Labour Party, it doesn't look so great, shall I say, understatement.
It doesn't look great, but the problem, George, here is that, okay, it's all very well for the so-called moderates, people in the centre, to say, well, Jeremy Corbyn, we think, has been a disaster, we think he's going to be an electoral disaster. But people in the centre have to have something more than, we're competent and this guy won't get us elected. There needs to be a moral cause for being a centrist or a liberal, or however you want to phrase your politics.
I couldn't agree with you more. And one of the reasons why the centre is failing. I think this is almost even clearer in France than any other country that I can think of, is that you have a socialist president who is now scoring some of the lowest ratings that a French president has ever scored because, among other things, the Socialist Party in France has lost both its reputation for competence and its reputation for any kind of moral drive. What do you have gaining at its expense? The political extremes, particularly the National Front in France.
Let's turn to what these extremes are. And I must say, I'm always slightly wary about when we talk about the political extremes, the left and the right, as if they are somehow two sides of the same coin. Because let's face it, Daniela, you know, when we look at what we're calling now the far left, whether that is Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn, whether that's Syriza or Podemos, they just have a different economic model. They don't have a hatred of foreigners, for example. Whereas when we talk of the extreme right, whether that is Marine Le Pen, whether that is Donald Trump and his decision to get rid of all Muslims coming into America, this is hatred of other people.
Yeah, I mean, I as a sort of weak, limp-wristed liberal, I agree with you completely. I think in many ways they're reactions to the same thing. The political centre, I think, has moved to the right. We can look in Europe. I think the issue of refugees and migrants, for instance, the centre has moved, I think, inexorably to the right on those issues.
Although it's interesting on those issues, George, you know, about refugees, there are people on the left, and again, if you want to be sort of relatively, you know, not specific and generalise a little bit, the sort of the working class left aren't necessarily going to be pro-refugee.
No, they're certainly not. Think back only to the British general election of May last year. UKIP, you know, the strongest of the parties emitting an anti-immigration feeling, well, unspecific, but that's what they were doing. They robbed Labour of a lot of votes in working class communities, particularly in Northern England. And the Labour Party didn't really see it coming until it was much too late.
Now, is this partly down to leadership and the fact that there are either charismatic leaders, be it a Nigel Farage or a Jeremy Corbyn in his own way, or sort of because he has that, you know, authenticity, the same way that some people say Bernie Sanders or indeed Donald Trump do, whereas the leaders in the centre, and we could sit here all day and name some of them, you know, just don't have that same charisma.
Absolutely. I mean, Labour really, really missed a trick there. I mean, there's an enormous amount of criticism to be made of the approach to the the general election. I mean, sometimes leadership can come from unexpected quarter. You know, France following the attacks and the transformation of a sort of marshmallow leader into a man of action. But I think charisma. It used to be what perhaps drove politics. I think it's in extremely short supply now, and that's why you get more marginal figures. I'm thinking George Galloway, for instance. Here is probably one of the most recognisable British politicians, even though he's really very much on the fringe. You know, people ask average people to name British politicians, and they might come up with him. They might come up with Boris Johnson, and it's the people with the charisma that actually make an impact. I don't think ideology is so much of a driving force.
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. I mean, you get conventional allegiances break up a bit. I mean, in Spain, the financial crisis has rewritten the political scene entirely. So you get new forces and new alignments and even new parties. And then to move them into a consistent succession of election wins, if you see what I mean, you need people who know how to nudge those people into the middle a bit. Not really clear quite whether that's coming from the left and the right, because it's happening in both cases. The French National Front, after all, is far less outwardly and obviously racist than it used to be. Now, lots of people say this is a deception and so on, but that argument will go on. But actually, it succeeded in convincing a lot of people that it isn't as dangerous as some people think it might be. From Spain, these changing forces are mostly coming from the left and moving into the centre. It's the person who can capture that move into the centre and do it charismatically. But they need a realignment to get started, I think.
And yet, George, on this issue, if we're going to look at who's actually been successful, the two most successful politicians in the West, arguably over the last decade, have been Barack Obama, loosely on the centre-left, and Angela Merkel, loosely on the centre-right. These are centrist mainstream politicians who, when it comes down to it, have actually won elections convincingly. All the other people we've talked about on the fringes haven't actually won a mainstream election.
Yes, but that, if I may say so, illustrates what I'm talking about. They have that ability to persuade their natural constituency to lean away from the ways in which it goes. They are persuasive. They can use that loyalty. I mean, Obama, in the case of the Democrats, said, sorry, we have to fight from the center. You're not going to like absolutely all of this. And he's managed that extremely well. Merkel, coming from entirely the other direction, has said to her right of center party, actually, we're going to have to lean into the center. And they've done it. That's the trick that's hardest.
OK, we'll leave it there just for now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, Daniela Pellid and George Brock. We'll be back with me after this.
Visiting Maison et Objet in Paris this January? Then come and say bonjour to the Monocle team and help us celebrate the 9th anniversary at our lounge, shop and cafe in Hall 7. Pop in for some smart shopping, peruse exclusive design collaborations and sample the best coffee at the fair, made by Allpress and the Monocle Café team. Monocle at Maison et Objet, in association with USM, Nicari and Allpress, at Paris Nord Villepinte. From the 22nd to the 26th of January, we look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me, Daniela Pellid and George Brock. To Switzerland now, high up in the Alps, where each year the global 1%, or a tiny proportion of that 1%, meet to chat, shake hands, exchange business cards, make deals and discuss what's going on in the world. It's time yet again for the World Economic Forum in Davos. Before we get into a discussion about whether Davos is any good or not, I should point out that Monocle 24 will of course be covering Davos to a certain extent. Our friends at Bloomberg will be chipping in on the briefing and the Globalist later on this week. But George Brock, should they be? Should we be bothering? Is there a point to Davos?
Well, it's not the same thing that it was. It's now just a gigantic conference. It used to be much more private. It used to be much more intimate. People met, and in those days when it began, people met much less often. Now they jet all around the place. They talk to each other by video conferencing and so on and so forth. So it can't be the same thing because technology in the world has changed. Does it really matter or make much of a difference? I don't think it makes an enormous amount of difference. But on the other hand, if some important corporate leader or statesman or something comes away from Davos and saying, do you know, I really didn't understand the importance of nanotechnology or whatever it happens to be, that's a gain. It's not a big gain. And we're only talking here about 0.001 of the population.
Well, indeed. But there's also, Daniela, a diplomatic argument, which is that now, up the top of a mountain in the middle of winter isn't necessarily the best place for lots of very important people to go. But the fact that lots of very important people are there does mean that some of them actually meet. And for example, we've got the new president of Argentina, Mauricio Macri, is going to be meeting with David Cameron to discuss the Falklands. There'll be all sorts of other side meetings here and there between maybe some Chinese and Japanese officials about the Senkaku or Diu Islands. All sorts of things happening behind closed doors, which wouldn't have been happening otherwise.
Well, behind closed doors and also on the fringes is where the most interesting things happen. And I'm always a bit sceptical about these high-profile conferences at which things are announced. I mean, the things that are announced have not been arranged there. You know, these are just vehicles for the announcement. But also, one of the problems with Davos as well, it's kind of become synonymous with some sort of weird bacchanal, you know, upper mountain. It couldn't be more exclusive, like a sort of semi-Bilderberg event. And actually, I mean, having heard of all kinds of events that have happened on the sidelines, there might be some truth to this. I mean, part of it is that everyone has got to be there, and they've got to throw these kind of slightly insane parties and conspicuously consume things. I'm not this sure this really goes down very well. I mean, that's its brand. That's what it has to
but
do. That,
but,
I,
But that's what's interesting, actually, George, this issue of its brand, because, you know, Davos likes to see itself as, you know, this is the World Economic Forum, it's where all the big thinkers sit and talk about the economy. But it has been made to look quite easily as this sort of meeting of the global elite that don't really understand what's going on. Oxfam every year put out a report just a few days before explaining how much of the world's money the tiny proportion of people at Davos actually control. They've got a bit of a brand problem, haven't they?
They've got a bit of a brand problem. And the problem is the scale makes truly original ideas very difficult to get out. Everybody wants to do everything. They want it to be acceptable to everything. When did you last think of Davos? Wow, that is a radical, daring, risky idea. I've heard the odd interesting idea of Davos, but radical and risky? Not really.
Okay, well, we will see whether anything radical and or risky comes out of Davos later this week. You can hear from our Bloomberg correspondents on Wednesday, Thursday and Friday on The Briefing. Finally, though, on today's edition of Midori House, one organisation here in the UK has just been named the country's best employer of lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender people. And the winner is, and this might come as a bit of a surprise, MI5, the UK's spy agency. Daniela Peled, is there something to be said for, you wouldn't have thought MI5 would be, or indeed its cousin MI6 would be seen as being the most sort of liberal and open of organisations, but it seems to be.
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think it's a wonderful story. It makes it sort of, you know, God save the Queen, proud to be British, kind of fantastic in terms of branding. Well, that's just great. I haven't seen any of the details, though, about what actually makes them such a friendly and welcoming employer. And I would really like to, I would really like to you know, hear the dull things, pension rights, you know, funding for sort of, you know, I don't know, the mind boggles. But also it's particularly delightful because our imagining of spies and spy novels, it's all about blackmail and subterfuge and shame and so on and so forth. And we seem to have passed out of that era as far as MI5 is.
Well, it's an organisation with a lot of history in concealment and deception. And once upon a time, for gays, that's what a lot of life was. So I think there's a sort of base, there's a foundation of mutual understanding there. I'm guessing, of course, because the only thing you can do about spy agencies is speculate.
But what's interesting about MI5 and MI6 over the last 10, 15 years is they really have tried to, you know, we talked about branding before with Davos. George, they've tried to change their image dramatically over the last 10, 15 years, haven't they?
Well, they have, and I think and quite largely they've been fairly successful, actually. It's been quite a clever branding exercise, really. Unlikely organisations can do it. And even in government, it can be done.
It's been a branding tool, but also a recruiting tool, because it has to reflect a more diverse range of demographic to actually be effective. So I think that's very much part of it. I think it's translated rather than just sort of working on its image to actually the profile of the people that work there and that they need to work for them.
And that, in fact, on that point, George, it is quite interesting how MI5 has realised that it needs to better reflect the population that it's serving and also the population it is, let's be honest, spying on.
My guess is it probably usually did reflect that, actually. What they're doing now is they're making that a bit more obvious in order to drive up the recruitment.
Do we expect anything to change in terms of the next Bond film? I think that might be pushing it, mightn't it?
That would be wonderful. The images that come into mind are just, you know, unspeakable.
I think movie producers are less radical thinkers than spies.
I think you're probably right there. As sad as that is to say, that movie producers aren't quite as liberal as they would like us to believe, and certainly as liberal as spy agencies. We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. My thanks to George Brock and to Daniela Peled. That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Henry Rhys Sheridan and Eugenie Deray. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Carlotta Ribello will be here next. And then at 1900, it's Section D, our weekly design show. We're back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 in London. That's 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.